Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org or on Facebook and Twitter and on our YouTube channel. I'm Catherine Ma, author of the novel The Year She Left Us, a New York Times editor's choice, and the short story collection All That Work and Still No Boys, winner of the Iowa Short Fiction Award. I serve on the jury of the Commonwealth Club's California Book Awards, and I'll be your moderator for today's program. Our guest is Adam Johnson, short story writer, novelist, and professor of creative writing at Stanford University. His novel, The Orphan Master's Son, was a literary sensation and was awarded the 2013 Pulitzer Prize and our very own California Book Award. His latest book, Fortune Smiles, is a collection of stories, both unnerving and funny. Six deeply humane tales of love and loss, man-made and natural disaster, the influence of technology, and how history and memory shape us. Adam was awarded fellowships from the National Endowment for the Arts and the Guggenheim Foundation. Fortune Smiles is a finalist for the 2015 National Book Award. Please join me in welcoming Adam Johnson back to the Commonwealth Club. Thank you. Thank you. Adam, congratulations on the National Book Award nomination. That's marvelous.
It's a great honor. Thank you. It's a real treat to be here to discuss writing with you.
Good. Well, let's begin by talking briefly about how you began as a writer, and then we'll talk about your latest book, Fortune Smiles. Can you tell us how you began writing stories? What are your origins as a writer?
I don't know if I can draw a clear line. I will say that I went to college late. I had after high school, I finished high school early, weirdly. And I went and worked construction, mid-rise construction, bridge construction. I was a concrete shoring foreman and carpenter. I drove tunnels for a year. I loved working with concrete. But it was Arizona, and it was very hot. And my mom finally said, if you'll go to college, I'll pay for it. I went to my local school, Arizona State University, and I wanted to be an engineer. I'd really admired all the engineers on the jobs that I worked. And but I encountered physics and calculus, Diffie-Q, and linear algebra was what finally did me in. But as I was kind of struggling to figure out college, like everyone seemed cooler than me. They'd seen like Kurosawa movies, and I didn't know who that was. I struggled to keep my GPA up in the face of all that physics. And I had a friend, he was a guru friend of mine, and every semester I would go to him and say, I need an easy A. And he would say, jazz appreciation. I remember him saying, family studies. There was the history of music. I did that. And in my sophomore year, I went to him in the spring, and he said, creative writing, the easiest day on campus. And I remember going into that class. It was taught by a professor who was new there named Ron Carlson, who is a teacher's teacher, a writer's writer, an icon in the world of writers, and he'd just been hired. He was wearing a suit to teach our fiction workshop, and he was radioactive with energy. He just charged all of our batteries. He was evangelical about the power of narrative. And all of my perceived flaws, like teachers my whole life had said, oh, Adam doesn't apply himself. Adam's an exaggerator. He's a daydreamer. He's a liar. He's a rubbernecker. Like all these things had been true about me. But in a fiction class, they suddenly came together to make something meaningful. And I'd never really encountered that in my life. Mm.
Who was your biggest champion when you were starting out? Was it Ron Carlson? Was he in your corner? Were there other people as well?
Well, he did take me under his wing. I think I showed no necessary aptitude for fiction writing. But I think Ron Carlson was getting a lot of stories about like dorm breakups, and I was writing construction worker epics, and I was writing about like job site injuries, and you know, I was writing a big piece about a place, some workplace violence I'd seen on a construction site, and I think he felt this was really interesting and different as a teacher. So
I'm remembering a Ron Carlson story Oxygen. Do you know that short story, which is a phenomenal story by Ron Carlson? But it is about a young man who, he's a college kid, and he goes to work construction one summer. Maybe he was writing about you, Adam.
Wow, I never thought about that.
We have to go back
and
check
the year.
I'm going
to send him an email tonight. Well, I borrowed so much from him, and I absorbed so much from him. It really was like the only epiphany I've had in my life. Very quickly, all my buddies were pounding on my dorm room on Friday night, saying, "You're late for the kegger." But I was in there typing. Nothing was as nourishing. No fun, no gratification was as satisfying as writing fiction to me. And I took the vow of poverty, which all writers must take, and decided I'd rather have this in my life than food. Yeah.
Is there a segment of the journey to becoming the writer you are today? Is there a segment of that journey that you've been thinking about lately, that you've been reflecting on? I'm sure it was a path with twists and turns.
I knew that I wanted to go to graduate school. I applied for some. I fell in love with a writer named Robert Olin Butler. He just had a book out in 93 called A Good Scent from a Strange Mountain. He had been in Vietnam, a linguist and an interpreter. And he had done this feat in which he'd written first-person stories in the voices of Vietnamese. And of course, when you write across your culture, when you try to transcend your experience, there's a lot of danger involved. Those representations have power, and the power to do harm as well as good. But his were so mesmerizing to me. He gave me permission early, his work, to write beyond my experience. He lived in rural Louisiana to be around the Vietnamese-American diaspora who lived there, many fishermen in Port Arthur and et cetera. So to study with him, I had to go there and live in Louisiana to find my mentor. And weirdly, he won the Pulitzer Prize, you know, for that book.
He did, a really fine book. And I remember at the time he was asked by the media about what it felt like to win the Pulitzer. We could get to that with you later. And he said, "It's like taking a warm bath in your own life."
That's Bob.
Let's talk about your latest book, this marvelous collection of stories, Fortune Smiles. Six powerful stories, each haunting, each wounding, sometimes very funny. Also, they really take up arms with the grand messiness of life, I would say. Family, love, betrayal, illness, sex. Sometimes illness and sex in the same scene.
That's right.
Separation, yearning. I think I read that five of those stories you wrote after you wrote your fine novel, The Orphan Master's Son, but one of them you wrote while you were writing the novel. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, certainly. You're a very perceptive reader. It's a joy to talk about writing with you. I had written a couple novels. It took a long time. I had missed stories, and I couldn't wait to get back to the form. I love their coiled power. A story to me like is a battery that stores pure emotion from the writer and holds it and delivers it to the reader, whereas a novel is a much larger proposition. But when I was working in The Orphan Master's Son, I had been pretty much a first-person writer. I love to catch voices. But I realized to get the scope of that book, to be able to enter certain venues, I was going to have to use a third-person point of view, and I really wasn't that good at it. And so I stopped the novel, and I wrote a story that's in this collection called Hurricanes Anonymous. It was in Best American Short Stories. But I kind of wondered, it was like a test run. Could I really pull off a very close, diluted third-person narrator and so tightly attached to the character? And that gave me some confidence that maybe the novel would work.
And then you returned to working on the novel. And did you finish that story while you were working on Orphan Masters?
I did. I had lived in Louisiana. I cared about Louisiana. And we all know about Hurricane Katrina, you know, that hit, August 26th, something like that, 2005. There's another hurricane that most people don't know about called Hurricane Rita that hit less than 30 days later. It was the most powerful hurricane to ever strike the United States from the Gulf. It was a Category 5, and it because of Katrina, a lot of people had got out of the way. But it was a devastating hurricane, and it swept through the poorest and most rural parishes of Louisiana. And I just had to go down there. I thought I was honestly going to do some fiction writing, but I went down there with my recorder and my camera and just lived in people's houses for weeks. And I became a UPS driver and things like that.
Your character in that story talks about the difference between events and developments. He says events are things that are visited upon you that you can adjust to. Mm-hmm. But developments are maybe moments in your life when something new is about to happen, even if you don't realize it at the time. And I love what you said about short stories being like a battery storing pure energy. I wonder if you think the short story form is a particularly good way to unearth this difference between events and developments in your characters' lives.
The purity of the short story comes from, you know, the distillation of the American story that we tell ourselves, that, you know, we have a certain inner desire that we maybe only kind of come to know and have that revealed when we decide and we make a choice to act upon it. But that action has consequences and there are reactions, and a cascade begins, which is we often call plot. But until we act on things, you know, they're not truly revealed. And maybe it takes wisdom and perspective to know what is going to change your life when it's happening. But it was a little bit of me writing about myself in that story. And I probably feel that, you know, my only epiphany in life was that fiction was for me. And that was my moment of development.
You just mentioned that you worked as a UPS driver to try to get a sense of that. Your main character is an extraordinary guy. He is a UPS driver, and he's delivering packages in the aftermath of Hurricane Rita all over the place, to work crews, to people, to homes that are abandoned. He ends up delivering by accident a package to himself at his former address.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about doing that research.
Well, you know, as an undergraduate, I fell in love with fiction, but I knew I could never make a living doing it. So I thought foolishly that I would become a journalist. That way I could make a living to support my fiction habit. But it taught me to edit, to write on deadline. Journalism taught me a love of interview, a deep love of interview and research. So, you know, I went to Louisiana. I went there for weeks and just stayed with friends. And I wanted to know what happened to a community. One of the interesting things is that 30,000 people were evacuated from Orleans and Beauregard Parish. If Louisiana's a boot, these people were in the toe, right? And they were moved to the heel, which is where Calcasieu Parish was in Lake Charles, only to be hit again by another hurricane. These people who had the double diaspora, whose lives were torn asunder twice, I really wanted to tell their stories. So some of those people had come from the hospital. Some people had come from the prison. So when I went to Calcasieu Parish, I found the sheriff. I found Department of Homeland Security, Fish and Wildlife people. I went along with utilities linesmen to show me how they got the power back going. I just went with everyone. And, you know, one of my discoveries in just researching what happens to people in a large disaster, and we're in San Francisco right now, so this may really affect us in some not perhaps too distant future, is that all the systems fell apart, the electricity, the power, everything was evacuated. And what kept working was UPS kept driving during the hurricane. And when I discovered this, you know, I called UPS World Headquarters, and I said, I want to meet your drivers, and I said, I want to drive. And they overnighted me, a brown uniform, double extra large, and they sent me on runs, and with veteran drivers who knew their routes, and there was nothing like it in the world. We would One day I delivered 324 packages. One day I did 200. But the drivers would drive up and they would say, "See where that house used to be?" They knew the story of the human being who had lived there and where they went or not where they went. Or we'd drive past a gas station and Mary Jane would hit the brakes. She'd say, "See that pickup? That's Mr. Broussard's pickup. You need to go into that gas station and find him and ask him what happened to his dog." And I would jump out of the UPS truck with my camera and my tape recorder, and I would go get these stories. And, you know, I discovered that when the infrastructure of society fell apart, Chuck E. Cheese kept making pizzas, and their manager stayed during the hurricane, and they you know, they're an outfit out of Utah. They gave away pizzas until there was nothing left. Walmart, whatever you might think of Walmart, the two Walmarts in Calcasieu Parish opened the doors and gave away everything. Every single thing in the story was free to people who'd, you know, been through this. UPS kept driving. So sometimes, these were the first responders. Mm. And that I wanted to capture that truth.
Your character mentions the Cajun word lagniappe, which he describes as getting more than you bargained for.
Right.
And a lot of the people in your story seem to get more than they bargained for, or they've gotten stuck in some way, they've gotten trapped. In the first story in the collection, which is entitled Nirvana, an incredible story, the woman who's the center of that story is literally trapped. She's paralyzed from the shoulders down.
Yeah.
That's an interesting place to begin a story. What are you thinking in terms of, you know, bringing your characters into that kind of situation? And then what you were talking about earlier, it's not until someone acts that their true self is revealed.
That's right. Well, with that Louisiana story, you know, when I was in grad school, just to finish that last thought, you know, I would work out in the gym with a guy who was a UPS driver. And, you know, he would always regale me with UPS stories. One of the stories he told me that really spoke to me was that one of the UPS drivers had become homeless and that UPS let him live in the warehouse and stay sometimes in his truck while he got back on his feet, and that it was that kind of an outfit. And so in that story, I always try to write against the grain if I can, to tell it slant, as Dickinson would say. Mm-hmm. And so in this story, Hurricanes Anonymous, our UPS driver is homeless and living in his truck when the hurricane strikes. So when everyone else around him is made homeless, he has no sympathy for them. The sheriff has taken all his possessions, and he's like, "You didn't need all your crap anyway. Everyone has too much stuff." And actually, the hurricane came and did everyone a favor. And so he has no sympathy for the survivors, no sympathy for them as he does his job to help them. And in the course of the story, he must come to see the humanity of everyone around him. And in this first story, Nirvana, maybe a more personal story. You know, it's when I was writing it, you know, my wife, Stephanie, you know, she went through breast cancer a couple years ago, and that put a lot of reverberations in our family and in our house. And, you know, that's what my mind does, is turn things into narrative. My life doesn't make sense until I put it into the meaning-making machine of a story. While that was going on, and our focus was all around that, a friend of mine from college, you know, took his life, and we'd been roommates, so I'd known him pretty well, but there was too much on our plate to go, like, to the funeral and to go deal with all that stuff. But when we were in college, we were roommates for 4 years, he would only listen to the band Nirvana, which meant that I only listened to the band Nirvana for 4 years. And after he took his life, while I couldn't go deal with all that, I started listening to Nirvana. And I started listening to it like exclusively. And I remember I walked into the Stegner workshop one day and I was like humming Nirvana. And one of the students said, "You walked in last week humming Nirvana." Someone said, "Actually, the week before that." And our kids started taking an interest in Nirvana. And we started talking about the lyrics and what was this band. And I think I was like wondering what in that music so spoke to my friend. And so I put Kurt Cobain, a wife with some illness and some other issues into a story.
And you make beauty out of pain when you do that. I mean, it's extraordinary how much of your personal life got transformed into story. It's not your life, you know, but I guess it's a starting place in a way, and then it becomes something shaped, something created that's separate from you. Do you feel that way, that the characters become separate from you as you write it and put it on the page?
Is there a difference between me and my characters during writing, like while it's happening? I would have to ponder that. How about you? Do you have this experience when you're writing that your character is you?
Very separate, yeah. Very quickly, I think they separate from me, and then they become creatures with minds of their own.
What about when you're starting to hear her voice in your head? Isn't that pretty close?
I suppose. You have a speechless character in that story who's actually very much a character, and that's a drone.
Right.
Who's sort of hanging around the house, kind of a malign R2-D2. You know, I thought of not the friendly robot, but this sort of malign character who's hovering in the house, perhaps collecting data on that family. What's going on in that house? What's going on in that marriage? Mm-hmm. You often write about technology. But what's interesting to me is it's not in the form of what we might think of as, you know, science fiction, where we get a dire prediction or a grim warning of letting loose the dogs of technology. It's more subtle. It's glimpses of the future, what the possibilities are, that what might come after we've created and really fallen in love with this technology that has changed our lives so much. So can you talk about what interests you about writing about technology, and what are the particular challenges in writing about that big, messy subject?
Yeah, I think I would probably divide technology into like two categories. You know, one are like machines with intelligence, robots, weapons that are smart, vehicles, things that are interacting with us in ways that we don't understand yet. And the other part is phones. I try to keep all phones out of my fiction. We're going to need a whole generation of writers who can integrate this to capture the truth of life now. I mean, at Stanford, I asked the Stegner fellows not long ago how they're handling phones in their writing, and all 10 of them said they were scared to death of it. And I think they're afraid of it because of this, because mode of writing is made on built on inertia, momentum, interiority, psychology, and withholding, moving toward confrontation, psychological engagement with others. But what if you have a device in which you can reveal your thoughts anonymously at a distance at any moment? Do you see how that kills drama? How that erases the necessity of human engagement, of real stakes interfacing with the people we love? And it seems like if your character has one of these things, it is going to ruin every meaningful human interaction, in my sense, which makes me wonder, what are they doing in our lives? What are they doing to our real interactions? I mean, do people express love through texts? I think they are. And what does that mean, that you don't face the person you love or make declarations from a distance, from anonymity?
Yeah, I think about the way phones, just as a device of communication, it opens this channel between people. We're now, I mean, if you take the phone out of it, communication is sometimes so difficult to achieve. Mm-hmm. But when you have the phone, and in a way, put a phone in a story, and all of those blockades to communication that create drama, that create tension, and that create plot,
right,
that goes out the window.
Of course.
My daughter wrote a wonderful essay, but what if, speaking of Anna Karenina, what if Vronsky could have just sent Anna a text?
Right.
You know, what if Romeo could have told Juliet, hang on, I'll be there in a day?
That's right.
The message, the whole plot function of the failed message, the message that doesn't connect, has gone out the window. And that, you know, I'm very surly about that, because I think as a writer, it's been taken away from us as a kind of a way of both examining emotional life and also adding drama to a story.
Yeah, I don't know how to handle it yet, but I'm sure there's some young writers for whom this form is absolutely natural, and it will come into their writing, and these books will articulate that experience, and I won't read them.
There is a quality in your stories of almost like three times at the same time. We're very located in the present. You give us devices. You give us Kurt Cobain. You give us Nirvana. You give us place names. So we're very located in the specific present. We get these glimpses of the future, as I was saying, and then there's a very timeless quality of the constant human condition. Do you think about that as you're writing? How is it that you pull off this miracle of keeping us located, present, future, timeless, all at the same time?
Well, you're very kind to speak that way. You know, I'm just a scene-based writer. I feel that contemporary fiction has most in common with the art form of jazz, and that a writer has concerns, has emotions, has a tradition, has had mentors, right, and has conventions and maneuvers, and this you know, writer, like a jazz musician, gets melodies and influences and wants to talk, and we put all that into a song, and the jazz musician doesn't know where it's going to go or what's going to happen. Or if it's going to totally fail. There's a lot of bad jazz out there. And if fiction's written in the right way, there's a lot of bad fiction too. Because it has to risk failure. It has to risk the unknown. You know, Ron Carlson told me when I was a young writer, he said, the secret to writing, and I'm going to give it away to all of you. It's just between me, Catherine, and all of you. I think it's also the secret to life, you know. Is he said, the secret to writing is learning to tolerate the not knowing. And that if you know where a story's going, it's dead. If you know the ending, it's over. Because you're just dictating, and you're not discovering, and there's no surprise, and there's no possibility of the story to become something. And the way I write is, you know, I create, I try to be, oblige myself to everything I've made, and I have no idea where it's going to go, really. And that's where my wife comes in, because I'll get to the ending of the story and I'll be like, I have no idea what's going to happen. And she'll be like, duh, you have a machine that brings people back to life in Nirvana, and you have a woman who loves Kurt Cobain. She's like, you have to bring Kurt Cobain back to life. Mm. You know, she saves me all the time from my own failures.
Well, that's a gift.
Yeah.
Of course, not knowing what's going to happen, that's delicious for the reader. That's the point of reading, too, isn't it? That we don't, that we live with the uncertainty the whole time we're traveling through the book with the author. Let me ask you about something else. I used to work at a law firm, and there were some great criminal defense lawyers there. These were people who were the true believers. You know, they were passionate about everybody's right to defend themselves in court. Mm-hmm. And so they represented all sorts of cases, the alleged embezzlers, defrauders, murderers. But there was one boundary line that they would not cross. Mm-hmm. I think you probably know what I'm going to say.
Fiction writers.
They would not.
They would never represent a fiction writer?
I'm in trouble. I won't be able to call any of my old colleagues. They would not cross that boundary line of representing what they would consider society's monsters. They would not represent someone who was accused of child pornography or child molestation.
Yeah.
In a couple of these stories, you've taken on the really difficult task of portraying those whom we might consider society's monsters. Yeah. In one story, a man who has pedophiliac urges. In another story, the former warden of an East German prison, prison that once was a site of torture and tremendous suffering and now is a museum. T- tell us what impels you to take on this really difficult task. You talked earlier about the about, you know, hearing those voices in your head and becoming the character. Why do you choose to write about those very difficult characters, and what particular responsibility comes with making that choice?
That's a great question. I think over the last 10 years, one of the things, a turn in my work has been, you know, being less inward and being more drawn to the stories of others, especially stories that are more rare. And I think writing The Orphan Master's Son changed my relationship to my work. I will say that one thing I discovered is that, you know, North Koreans weren't able to tell their own stories for many reasons. Defectors had a very difficult time telling their stories. And so instead of being a great silence in the world, I do believe this, that one thing that literature can do is project your humanity inward, even if their stories couldn't get out. And if we do believe that we are all humans, driven by the same commonalities and impulses, that we're all valuable. I mean, I think we've all bought into this humanist belief that every soul is valuable in this world. And, you know, it's tricky in application, though. And in writing that book, I wanted to keep Kim Jong-il out of it for these sole reasons, that we had a colored portrait of him that was not accurate. We saw him in American media as a clown or an evil person or a crazy person, but he was a human. And when I realized I finally had to put him into the book, then I was tasked with doing the job of literary fiction and making him as psychologically real as possible and rounding him out. And I had to go hunting for sources of his intelligence, of his humor, of his strengths, of his vulnerabilities and weaknesses.
His creativity.
And creativity. He was a very intriguing figure, yeah, though he did monstrous things. Mm-hmm. And the second someone becomes a monster, you've divorced yourself from the need to apply humanity to them. And I'll say I became curious about, like, filling out these portraits. Every Thanksgiving, I go to Arizona, and my family meets with another family, and I see a human being once a year on one day on Thanksgiving. And when we go to this Thanksgiving party, I walk past the cranberries and the smoked turkey, and I always talk to this guy. And his name is Josh, and he works for the Arizona Correctional System, and he counsels sex offenders inside the prisons, and he helps them transition to the outside. He runs group therapy sessions. And these are men who are rapists, who've molested stepdaughters, who've done all these crimes. And every year I talk to him about the work that he does, which fascinates me. And he always, always, always reminds me of the humanity of these people, how they are humans who made the worst possible mistakes, that they may never be able to come back from them, and yet they must strive and struggle, and that some of them are victims as well, mm-hmm, and that they are fighting a daily battle every day of their lives to be decent human beings despite very powerful urges to the contrary. That's character. When you talk about literature, people who are daily trying to define themselves and be heroic, to not succumb. That's what literature's about. Those are the kinds of compelling characters. And, you know, I wondered if I could find the humanity of such a character myself. Mm-hmm. And I had a few things going for me. He's a character who cannot articulate to anyone in the world what he's truly feeling. And I think reader sympathies go out for a character like that. He's a character in a trap, a very dark and painful trap. And I think readers respond and cast our sympathies out there. And of course, he is a character who struggles night and day to never hurt anyone, despite his urges. And he's waging a battle you would never see if you saw him. And to me, he's a heroic character. And he tells his own story in the first person. And I think it's a very troubling story for people to read, because I don't think you can read it without sympathizing with him. And he does this dangerous maneuver. He is sexually attracted to the girls next door, and they have no one to take care of them, and he decides that he's going to prove that he's not a monster by taking care of them. And if he makes one mistake, there's no greater consequence. And so the tension of the stories was very difficult to take in writing it.
Let me pause and say...
That didn't sell any books. My stories are also funny, and the language is beautiful, and there's humor in there. And yeah.
This is the Commonwealth Club of California program, and we are talking to Adam Johnson, Stanford University professor and author of The Orphan Master's Son, and his new book, Fortune Smiles. I'm Catherine Ma, your moderator. You can hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio, catch up with us on Facebook and Twitter, and see program videos on our YouTube channel. I do want to go back. It's a marvelous story. It's actually a very redeeming story. And as I was reading that story about the Mr. Roses, mm-hmm. the man with these very dark urges, I was thinking of that Eudora Welty story, Where is the Voice Coming From? Which Welty wrote the night that the civil rights activist Medgar Evers was murdered.
Right.
And she writes that story from the point of view of a white supremacist who goes out and murders a civil rights activist. It was later reported that she did such a convincing job of inhabiting that man, of understanding that character and that voice, that the FBI came and interviewed her. Right. Because they wanted to know who is this person? What would be in the mind of someone who would do such an act? So you've talked about this prodigious research you do, mm-hmm. putting on the brown suit and delivering 300 packages, talking to Josh at the family holiday. So you do have a reportage to your work. You know, you really anchor it in reporting and in nonfiction, but... Is there something about fiction, too, that gets at some deeper truth, that gets at, you know, really looking at people in a more whole way than reporting can get us?
Mm-hmm. I will say the one story I never researched was this story, Dark Meadow, that was about a person who... has these sexual urges. I started to, and then I went to my Google bar, and I realized, oh, my God... You know, in this society, I honestly don't feel like I could type in any of these words that would lead me to serious, research. You know, in talking to my friend Josh, I was just, before I started writing the story, I said, wow, I really want to know one of these human stories. And he invited me to the prison to come to one of the support groups, and I may take him up on that. But I said, is there a book? Is there a memoir? You know, I mean, think how difficult and brave it is for someone who's the victim of such a transgression to tell his or her own story. Those stories are very, very rare. But the truth is, the offender, the person who's going to say, I did this unspeakable thing. Here's what motivated me. Here's how I did it. I'm sorry. Let me just share this with you, what I became. It doesn't exist. I asked him if there was anything in English that he knew of. He said, aside from professional literature, there is nothing. And those people aren't allowed to tell those stories. We wouldn't be able to take it, I don't think. There's a story in this collection about a Stasi warden as well. And when I went to Germany, I became very fascinated with the Stasi culture. And I said, is there a memoir? I asked them in every city we went to, everyone I met, I said, is there a good memoir of a Stasi officer who tells all? And they said, oh no, that could never exist in Germany. No one would ever publish such a book. No one would write one. And suddenly I was like, I have to write one. I have to do that. Like, something about me I have to fill that void. I mean, if someone's going to write about a divorce or an affair, I wouldn't write about that. I would go read Ann Beattie or Richard Ford. There's so many great artists who have covered so many things. But here's an absence, and I can't tolerate that. I'll answer your question. I'm sorry.
No.
I'll shut up. I'm sorry. The question was about fact and truth, yeah.
Well, I think you've answered it. I think you've answered it. When one of your characters says, I have acquired a keen sense of dark trajectory. And I think these stories, as you've described them, clearly have a keen sense of dark trajectory. But they're also, they're very funny. And you have a serious and also very humorous story about two North Korean defectors. They defect, they leave North Korea, they find themselves in Seoul. They're hanging out at Seoul fast food joints. They're going to defector support groups. It's like a bad buddy movie. You know, it's like a buddy movie gone awry. Talk about the humor in your writing. I mean, does that just show up like a birthday present when you're writing? Do you grope for it or does it arrive? You probably have some innate sense, I would imagine, that when you do write about these untellable stories, that there are still going to be moments of humor to be found in the nooks and crannies.
Well, I think darkness and humor are, you know, cotangents in a way. If something's just funny and not dark, it's just like a helium balloon. It just floats away. If a comedian tells jokes and they aren't a little dark and sinister, you can't remember any of them afterward. And comedians are the darkest figures in our society, if you look at their lives. And when I tell dark stories, I mean, tension builds, especially when I read them. When I literally read them in public, I can feel the unease. I can feel people start to shift after a certain while. And that something is building in them, the tension of the story. And if I don't put humor in a story to control how that tension is released, the reader's going to release it in certain ways. And I've read stories. I read that story, Dark Meadow, and people laughed nervously in weird places. And I realized, if I don't put a joke in there and control that, then they're not going to know how to take this story. But I think every person is given some gifts in life, whether they play the piano or do ceramics. And in writing, I was probably given a couple. But then you got to go learn all the other ones. I was maybe naturally a little funny in writing. My dialogue, my original workshop told me how bad my dialogue was. So I had to go listen to some people for a while.
And where did you listen? Did you listen to actual people, or you listened in movies and theater, the way other writers treat dialogue, or were you actually the young man sitting in the cafe eavesdropping the people next to you and scribbling down their lines in your notebook?
Well, you know, I do invite my students, my undergraduates at Stanford, to do exactly that, to go to a cafe where people around them would have a reasonable expectation of being overheard, and to transcribe some dialogue. And, you know, we learn certain things that... you know, maybe 40% of dialogue is interrogative. It's questions. When people talk to each other, they ask each other questions constantly. And that the more intimate and close the people are, the more they finish each other's sentences, the more their thoughts are not necessarily complete, and the more there are unsaid things. And I love to do this in dialogue. To have two people talking about something and you're not quite sure as a reader what it is, makes you lean in and look for cues. And the mistake is what a lot of people do is they make it expository and they put too much information in dialogue, which is not natural and boring. So it's probably hardest to learn to be funny than anything. But people have to do it because you may have a funny character who comes along.
Yeah. We have quite a few questions from people in the audience about the Orphan Master's Son. In particular, people are very curious to know more about the research you did for that book.
Right. Now, you confessed earlier in the night that you were going to take those pieces of paper and ask any question you wanted. So is this really you, or is this the audience? Okay, all right. Well, I can understand the question, because North Korea is a real place, and yet I wrote a work of imagination set there. I did a lot of research in trying to make my portrayal and representation. Though there aren't many representations of the place. There are not many other places to look. I can recommend some books, in due course. But one of the important things in researching, it's not like I'm really going to archives like a scholar. When I say research, I mean talking to human beings, getting human stories, talking to people whose house blew away in a hurricane, meeting someone who's been tortured in a Stasi prison. for example. Like, what that does is, when a human being tells you a story, especially a powerful one, like, that takes up residence in you. And it's going to stay a long time. They actually stay with me. Like, reading the stories of North Koreans when I became curious about this place, like, it was like, each one was like a stone in me. And eventually writing was the only thing I could use to make something that mattered out of it. And, you know, like, if you meet a veteran in the airport, someone who's wearing fatigues, I mean, some part of you might want to say, did you serve in Afghanistan? What was your experience in Iraq? But they're going to give you a story that may be troubling. And you may be obligated to speak back to that or to return a story. I like that discomfort. Also, I don't necessarily just use people's stories that way, but they become the emotional bar that I measure my own work by. And so when you talk to a defector who, like, you know, starved, someone in their family starved to death, and they tell you about that, like, you come into possession of that, and you're going to be in possession of it forever. I'll say about writing the book, two things. One is, as a fiction writer, I had a lot of advantages over journalists. I think the poverty of journalism about North Korea is because nothing can be confirmed or verified. Any story cannot be traced back to a source. There's no second party to confirm anything. But for the fiction writer, legend, rumor, nightmare, hearsay, right? Feeling, the unsaid things. I consider that research. That was very emotionally valuable to me. So, and the other thing I'll say is that I was doing my standards weren't as high as nonfiction, so I would read stuff, and I didn't always write down every source I got. But I had a source for almost every single detail in the book, a factual source, whether it was someone getting his or her a tattoo cut off or things like that. But the truth of the book, what is it like to grow up in North Korea in a totalitarian regime where you do not get full possession of your own identity, where you do not get to imagine a future you, and you're not entitled to try to find a path toward becoming your best possible self, where your self is curtailed. The answer to that is only North Koreans know that. You know, there's no way I could know that. And so defectors are as close as we can get right now, but for many reasons, their stories are complicated. Hopefully freedom will come to North Korea, and they'll tell their stories, you know.
In the final story in Fortune Smiles, right, is these two defectors from North Korea who come to Seoul. So it's very interesting that you return to that subject, but, you know, the lens has turned a bit now, and yeah, we're seeing, and in fact, the boss, the more powerful of in terms of political power, economic power of the pair, he sort of works with the system in North Korea.
Right.
So he's not, you know, the person trapped in the mine or the prison camp, right, or something like that. He actually has some freedom. He can move
elites
around.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about that story, because it's very interesting that, and it comes after you had given us this, you know, very detailed and this tremendous work of imagination in the novel, and then in the story we're turned slightly.
You can go to Seoul, and you can talk to people in South Korea. It was so eerie traveling to North Korea and knowing, as you're among thousands of people in the capital, that if I could just talk to one person, if it was legal, if it wasn't a crime to have a conversation with one person, all my questions would be answered. Like, I wouldn't need years of imagination. But it wasn't possible. It was so eerie to do that. In writing The Orphan Master's Son, I inadvertently, I believe, gave a sense that all you had to do was get out of North Korea and life was great. Maybe relatively. But I knew that wasn't the truth. I couldn't handle that portrait. The novel had its own aims. But, you know, in reading the stories of defectors, in talking to them, it's not that way at all. Their lives are very difficult when they get out. They're going from a land that has yet to see its first stoplight to Seoul, one of the most sophisticated cities on earth, much more sophisticated than this city, as cool as we think Silicon Valley is. And they're also going into a place, a country that has moved on without them. Despite sharing 4,000 years of common Korean history, South Korea has moved on. And they're oddly indifferent, maybe not oddly, but they're relatively indifferent to the plights of North Koreans. People there struggle, they have lots of problems, and I just thought it wasn't responsible of me to not show this other side. So, you know, I interviewed a couple defectors who were elites in North Korea, very interesting, very rare defectors. One was named Jenjin Sung, and I interviewed him in Australia and in New Zealand. And Park Sang-hak was a gentleman I interviewed in Seoul. And they talked about their lives, working for the regime, being elites. They had cars, Mercedes, and drivers. But they also ran for their lives when the time came because they were going to die. And even these people had such struggles adapting to the South that I just wanted to make this portrait.
It's a wonderful story. Yeah, we were talking earlier about Eudora Welty, and she has written that the novel should not be used as an instrument of crusade or of reform. And you've taken on these massive subjects. You've done incredible work, research, and writing around North Korea. I'm wondering if you have a sense of where that boundary line is between the novel that has some political muscle in it and the novel that becomes a crusade. She says the novel is the work of the novelist is to take life as it is now and to make it into an object that's filled with this life and offer it to the reader, not to be used as a as an instrument of, you know, of the zeal of reform.
Right.
I'm sure you've thought about that.
Well, the second you start putting your own causes in the mouths of characters, then they become very uninteresting, and they become that annoying person at the party where you kind of say, I'm going to get another glass of wine, and you don't go back to them. You know, but there are books. I mean, The Grapes of Wrath is as timely today as it is any other time. But usually crusading is the realm of nonfiction. Wendell Berry's a contemporary writer who is a crusader. And, you know, poetry and and the essay are his, you know, media. I remember when I was an undergraduate, I took a class called Vietnam. I was like, what? You know, it was like 1988, 89. I was like, What? I was watching all these movies. I was like, what was this thing? And it was very fascinating, very serious class. But we read Stanley Karnow's, you know, tome, Vietnam. And it was a 1,000-pager, and it was the definitive work on the war. And I learned a lot. But afterward, we read Graham Greene's The Quiet American, which is a slim, taut, nearly perfect novel about an American who goes over there with good intentions, and what does it mean to be engaged at all costs, and what does it mean to be disengaged? And these two men, this old reporter and this young American, are both vying for the love of a young Vietnamese woman that neither of them see the humanity of, that neither of them really care to understand. And that was it. I was like, oh my God, this was Americanism, you know, in this region. I've always believed the novel can do things that reportage can't.
Here's another question from someone listening to our conversation. When assembling a collection of short stories, do you always work on a cohesive theme, or do you work randomly and then see how the collection pulls itself together?
Right. Well, this is a question for the kind of writer who writes 30 stories and decides, I'm going to collect these 8 gems. They all fit together. You know, I'm a slow, laborious writer. And I only had 6 stories, so I just stuck them all in. So the question is probably just the order. I put maybe the creepier stories later, so I didn't lose you. and the story was kind of sexy at the beginning to hook you. It was pretty simple. But I do love and care about the short story a great deal. I think having written a couple novels in a row, I became a maximalist. The stories are, it's a 300-page book with six stories, so they're 50-pagers. I think there's a character at the center of each one that's capable of driving a novel, but I tried to condense them as much as possible. And they're powerful stories. I'm really proud of them. Yeah.
Absolutely.
I don't know if I'm not supposed to say that. It makes me sound arrogant, but I am.
No, they're marvelous. And I actually sense a kind of freedom in the writing and almost a sense of glee. I was wondering whether it's because you have spent a lot of mental time in North Korea, in East Germany, in other places. I felt like there was a sense of Adam saying, I have freedoms that so many others don't. I can think what I want. I can write what I want. Yeah. I can put it out there. And I felt like a kind of exultation as I was reading it. Like there's this sort of sense of unfettered glee of, I'm going to write about this because I have the freedom to do that. Am I misreading that?
No. I mean, well, I also love short stories. And we're in a renaissance of the short stories. I mean, Lori Moore made me want to be a short story writer, and George Saunders and Tobias Wolff and, Liz McCracken and Phil Klei. There's so many amazing collections out there right now. What about yourself? You wrote a collection and then a novel. Have you been drawn by the glee of the story, or are you working on another novel?
Novels. I love the story. And actually, the thing I'm working on now seems to be situated somewhere between the two, so we'll see what happens with it. But stories, the compression of a story energizes the work. Mm. But, the big baggy novel, that's what I love to read. And we all probably in the end write books that we ourselves want to read. Right. So the novel form, the freedom of the novels is very appealing to me. Mm. Give us a moment just to talk a little bit about the prizes. What does it do having won these accolades for your work? Does it free you up even more? Does it give you a greater sense of responsibility toward the work? Does it set the bar very high, or do you feel a kind of independence now?
Well, that's a great question. The truth is there's only a few big prizes, and when that imprimatur is put on your work, you are free to kind of do anything you want forever. And I'm a lucky person already. I was already at Stanford, and I felt that freedom already. Inspiration from my students. I had tenure, which is true academic freedom. And at that, and I could write about a creepy pedophile with a heart of gold and not get fired there. And so my kids are still going to have braces and, maybe go to college. My wife's here, when this thing happened to my book and it won the Pulitzer Prize, we sat on the couch and we live in Coal Valley and the fog was going by the window. I remember it really clearly. And we sat kind of in the bay window and, we had a talk. And I said, this could change our lives. Because we know people who are in these positions and we see the lives they have. I said, we could probably do anything we wanted with this. And we looked at how lucky we were to live in the city. Seriously. We looked at our three beautiful kids. We looked at my wife's health, that I am inspired by my students and I teach in one of the great places. And we didn't want to change anything. Mm. And we made a pact to just pretend it never happened. The people remind me all the time, but we're doing our best.
Three of the six stories appeared in the literary journal Tin House.
Yeah.
What's your sense of writing and having the stories come out before they appear in a book? Tell us about your relationship with Tin House, and also just more generally the role of literary magazines.
Right.
And leave a little room right at the end because I have a special little thing I want to do right at the end.
Uh-oh. I love literary journals and magazines. You know, when I was a grad student, an MFA student, I would haunt the Current periodical section, and I would read the Missouri Review and the New England Review and Virginia Quarterly Review, and see who was out there, what were they making, and, you know, that impulse is often filled now, like reading the Stegner applications at Stanford. Lots of young contemporary writers are always sending their best work, and my finger is on the pulse that way. But, you know, there are very few venues to put your work out there. With stories as long as mine, you know, only so many places can I can send a 60-page story and have people say, yeah, we need to publish this. That means, like, that's the length of three stories. That means they have to say no to two people. It has to be as good as, you know, it has to fit their standards. So I was really lucky to have Harper's publish a big, long story. They don't have much room. Esquire published a big, long story. They don't often have a chance to do that, and I was the benefactor of that.
Did you add any material for the book? Did they shave it down to go into a magazine or a journal?
No, the editors really liked, you know, the director's cut, I suppose. Mm-hmm. But, you know, these journals are keeping writing alive. And in the Bay Area, you know, we're lucky to have Zizova and Three Penny Review and some wonderful outlets. And, you know, I read and support these places, and I'm proud to have my work in them.
Great. Okay. Almost at the end, we have time for a final question. What I'd like to do is a quick fire round. I have stolen this format from a marvelous actor. His name is Rex Young. He's at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival in Ashland. And Rex often does interviews of his colleagues and the other actors, and he does a quick fire round at the end.
Is this really like a psychological test?
This is easy.
Okay.
I'm just going to ask you quick questions, and I'm just looking for a one-word answer.
One word.
I'm going to give you choices. One word. Yeah. Ready?
Yeah.
Tea or coffee?
Coffee.
Cat or dog?
Dog.
Pen or pencil?
Laptop.
Crossword or Sudoku?
Neither.
Shark or whale?
Oh, God, that hurts.
I knew this one was going to be hard for him.
Both endangered. The shark, we've got to save our sharks.
19th century or 20th century?
Man, I'm an 18th. I love the 18th century novel.
18th century or 21st century?
Oh, God, you're good. You're good. The pioneers are the futurists. I'll take the unknown. I'll take the future, yeah.
Kalbi or bulgogi?
Oh, man. I would, you know, my kids like the bulgogi. They don't like the rib bones. I'm going to go with Kalbi.
Chekhov or Shakespeare?
Chekhov.
Stanford Cardinal or Stanford Tree?
Oh, the tree. Yeah, I've taught many trees. It's always great to have a mascot in your class.
Yeah. Really? The mascot is actually...
Yeah.
Dude, you need the A. Creative writing with Professor Johnson.
That's exactly
He'll
it.
Pass even
exactly
a tree.
It.
And final question, Thelonious or Miles?
Wow, I would go with the monkster, yeah.
Our thanks to Adam Johnson, Stanford University professor and author of The Art of Master Sign. We also want to thank our audience here and on radio, television, and the internet. I'm Catherine Ma. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.
Oh, you are amazing. You're a natural.